Breaking records is often a positive thing, but when it comes to weather and climate, we seem to keep breaking records that would be better left untouched, I think. We're going to find out the latest global warming record that we've surpassed and what it means as we talk with our weather guys. Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, thanks for coming by again.
Oh, it's great to be here again.
And John Martin, a professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, on sabbatical this year, but comes anyway.
Yeah, I wouldn't miss it.
I'm really great to have you both here. And certainly, if you have weather, climate questions, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions and your comments there. You know, it does seem like we keep breaking records that we'd probably rather not break. Mm-hmm. I think the first quarter of 2015, global temperatures the warmest ever.
For the global temperatures, warmest ever. And, of course, when you look at those global maps, you know, we usually recommend, or we usually color above normal temperatures in red and below normal temperatures in blue. And, of course, right over the Midwest and New England was blue. So mm-hmm. we were below normal for the first quarter, but globally
that just makes it even more interesting.
Right, yeah. Why this area below normal?
That's right. Yeah. Very, very interesting question. I don't know the answer yet, but I have the data that might point me in the direction. And I think I'm one of the only people working on that directly, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, I opened the paper this morning, the local paper this morning, and there was a piece in there from somebody who said, well, these people who talk about global warming are nuts because I had snow last week and snowflakes coming down, and so all I have to do is look outside and find out that those guys don't know what they're talking
right.
about.
Right, and similarly, the Brewers are having a great season because they won yesterday. It's just ludicrous. It's a terrible way to argue.
If you win one inning.
Right,
We won the game.
We were better in the third inning. We should have won the game. You can't think that way. Yeah. It's a much broader perspective you have to take.
Yeah. Well, and how is all this determined, by the way?
Surface temperature is the one that we're talking about right now. Yeah, so they just take a whole bunch of standard observing sites that mm-hmm. are you know registered somehow as top level observing sites around the world, and then they take the average of those trends at all of those thermometers and figure out that hey, this particular quarter of this year was warmer than any other particular quarter, similar winter quarter of any other time before. But I can tell you that my own research has told me that. This is 2 years in a row now. I've anticipated this result because I keep track of the aerial expanse of the cold air pool in the lower troposphere, about a mile above the ground. And mm-hmm. last year was the record smallest for the whole December, January, February 3-month average out of a 67-year time series. And I thought, well, we won't see that again. This year was even smaller on average. So we broke the record in consecutive years. And so I've known that since March 1st, that at least by my measure, it was the warmest winter ever. And then now it's coming that the averaging of all the surface thermometers is saying the same thing. Very interesting.
And I think it's important, as John's pointing out in here, it's usually not just one type of measurement, but it's the multiple variety of measurements that are all done consistently. So it's not anecdotal. There are systemic ways of analyzing these data.
That's a
really
good point.
Well, I think there was another one was sea ice.
Yeah,
depth
and the amount of sea ice. I was just talking to Jeff Key, who is a NOAA person on campus who does a lot of work in the Arctic, and he was saying that at the end of February, that was the minimum extent of the sea ice that they've ever seen.
How interesting, because that's again exactly in line with this lower tropospheric temperature trend that I've seen over the last, in that case, 30 some years. They use the satellite record for that to kind of make it so we're comparing apples and apples. Unbelievable.
Well, there's a lot of there should be some cause for concern then.
I think there is. Yeah, there should be some cause for concern. Yeah,
should be concerns to be talking about it and trying to figure out.
Yeah,
what do we do about this?
That
we
was know really that something. I mean, there's really been some talk about some state officials being banned from working on or discussing climate change. I know one person is affected is Tia Nelson, who is executive secretary of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, and of course, daughter of Gaylord Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
who you know, thought up Earth Day.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I could see people telling people, look, you got to focus on your job and you got to do what you got to do. But to ban words, and particularly in that job where you're looking at our resources and we know the climate is changing in this area, that's going to impact our resources, it's going to impact our economy, it's going to impact our culture, and to just pretend that it's not there and to ignore it.
It's the sort of thing that you tell your 3 or 5 year old, you know, you can't just pretend that your homework doesn't have to get done, you know, and then it won't need to get done. You have to pay attention to the problems as they come up. Plus, she was harangued for work that she'd done 5 or 6 years ago under a different administration.
We should not ban words. We should not ban books. We should have intellectual conversations.
Well, I mentioned earlier, this kind of, I don't know if this is a parallel or an interesting parallel, the National Weather Service banned the use of the word tornado. And that was...
Yeah. Yeah. And that Steve put together a letter to the other. I don't think it's been out there yet. I'm surprised. But, yeah, the idea was that maybe the panic that would ensue in the general populace upon hearing this word tornado would be more devastating than the tornado itself, which is an absolutely ridiculous proposition. And, you just can't help but draw a parallel between that sordid story from the past and what's happening right now around the country. It isn't just in Wisconsin. In fact, it's not as acute in Wisconsin as it is in places like Florida, Texas.
And it makes so much more sense to educate people about what these terms mean so that you don't think that a snowball in a building can refute global warming.
Right, right.
You know, people understand that, no, that is really not an our scientific argument for turning something around.
Why are we in this belt here of a little colder than normal?
That's a good question. One of the things that happens every winter is we tend to get a couple of sort of standing atmospheric structures. One of them's a big trough over Hudson Bay. That's a climatological feature. The exact southern, western, eastern dimensions of that climatological feature vary from year to year. So if it's a little bit more south and west than it usually is, that puts the northern plains in the crosshairs of getting continuous invasions of cold air. If it's a little bit further to the east and south, then that's New England. And if it's a little bit weaker generally in one year than the next, then no place comes away saying that it was particularly cold this winter. So that all three of those are quite likely occurrences from one year to the next. But to really go back and say, how come this year and last year were so persistently in one of those tracks is a really interesting scientific question. It takes some time to unravel. I'm trying to do some of that now.
Michael in Danbury is up with a question. Hi, Michael. Thank you for calling.
Hi, and thank you for listening. Gentlemen, I'm battling with myself and discussions with others about this whole climate change, and I was watching a program this weekend about this wonderful glacial trail that we're cutting through the state of Wisconsin, which was the landmark left by the ice age and stuff. And as I listen, my struggle is that we've had that. Why isn't it just a continuation of the ice receding? And why isn't this just simply a normal process that the planet is evolving through? You know, we found Macedon materials in the frigid areas like Antarctica and Siberia and stuff. And, you know, we've had volcanoes belching out stuff much greater intensity than the man could ever imagine. My problem is this: why isn't this just normal?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a very reasonable question. It's a reasonable place to start, you know, questioning what's going on. There's a couple things I can say, and Steve will have some others to say, I'm sure. One of the things that's clear in the record, as far as we can reconstruct it by examining the chemical composition of bubbles of air that are trapped in ice that's been deposited at South Pole and various other places hundreds of thousands of years ago, is that the reconstructed values of carbon dioxide fraction in the atmosphere are at their peak in those long geologic records only 75% of where we are right now. In addition, if you look at a little bit more recent data, maybe the last 1,000 years or so reconstructed, some of it reconstructed, some of it observed, you find that the carbon dioxide fraction was, for about 800 of those years, hovering right around those maximum values from the long geologic record, which is not surprising, somewhere around 300 parts per million. In the last 150 or so years, it's gone up to almost 400 parts per million. And so these are values of carbon dioxide fraction that are unprecedented in the Earth's atmospheric history, at least in the last half million or more years. And in addition, it comes exactly coincident with the use of fossil fuels for powering our industry. So there's a beautiful confluence of these two, one observation, one circumstance, that really do sort of suggest strongly, in fact, more than strongly suggest, that that's the reason we have such an increased greenhouse potency now and has led to the warming of the planet in this instance. There may be something going on in the background, but that's not the main driver right now.
Mm. Steve, you're in a...
Yeah, I think I'd just reiterate what John was saying, because I'm a faculty and we like to just reiterate what our colleagues say. And that is, you're raising a really good point. That is that, you know, to look at this, you really need to look at a long time series. And when you look at those long time series, you see cycles of temperatures going up and down, of ice sheets going up and down. And when you look at the long time series we have now, the first thing that really sticks out is what the heck is going on in these last 50 years. That's where we're seeing really big changes. And as John is saying here, when you try and pull that out, is it volcanoes? No, it can't be volcanoes because we haven't had enough volcanoes go off to call this kind of change. Can it be ocean circulations? No, it can't be. So we kind of go through this process of elimination, and the only thing that can explain the type of thing that we're seeing is the human impact on our atmosphere, particularly with regard to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
May I have another question?
Sure.
This is really interesting, and my comment would be is that, okay, so what? So it's climbing and it's doing this and so forth. We may be contributing to it, we may not. There are a lot of influences. So we're just evolving through time, heading as we always have been, with all kinds of influences, whether it be man or whether it be the aquatic life in the oceans. Which, of course, brings up another situation is, what about this 90 billion tons of biomass being removed from the ocean every year through fishing, and the mass, the density of the ocean is becoming less, and nobody's talking about that.
Can I begin on one of your first premises on the second question, which is maybe we're contributing, maybe we're not. There's really no maybe there. And so a consequence of that being eliminated as a maybe is the fact that, you know, besides the fact that you're correct that things evolve naturally in addition to what you can do the way we've been changing the atmosphere, we have a civilization we have to maintain, and we'd like to maintain, I think, on a very populated planet. And so if we start screwing around with the climate to a degree that starts to alter weather patterns regionally and maybe even globally to an extent that suddenly we're not able to sustain 6 billion people on the planet with the amount of food we can grow because the arable land changes its distribution and so on, we've got real problems. So we do have an obligation to kind of think about putting a halt on this, because it's no longer a question that maybe we were involved. We are involved.
We are involved. We're talking, and thanks, Michael, for calling. Talking with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys. They'll be with us right up till 12:30. Quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Never a shortage of things to talk about with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They always have something interesting to talk about, whether it's tornadoes or climate change or what it's going to be like in the next week. We can talk with them about it, and you can certainly join in with your questions and comments. John, of course, a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the UW. John, great to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry. And seeing your fabulous blue shirt really makes my day.
Well, Steve Ackerman, he's got a kind of a purplish shirt.
I can wear
equally fabulous.
Right.
Yeah.
We're doing interviews today, so I got a tie on, too.
Oh, you got a tie on as well. He directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, also, of course, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And as always, Steve, great to have you with us.
It's fun.
We have lots of callers online with weather climate questions, so let's just go back to the phones. Jess, been waiting a bit. Jess, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, no problem. Two quick questions, really. One, the first thing about the department that wants to limit the speech of the employees, that should be a constitutional issue, a First Amendment issue, first of all, and especially when talking about climate change, when you're in a department dealing with natural resources and the climate has an effect on the resources, how could you not talk about it?
Good question.
So the idea, it's a First Amendment issue. Secondly, I think it's an Eighth Amendment issue where it's a lack of due process to take the person's right away, which no entity, no job outside of the judicial system has a right to do. So yeah. That's one issue. The second issue is what do chemtrails or chemical trails, how do they play in the change in the weather patterns and so on?
All right. Thanks for calling, Jess. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, chemtrails are, they don't exist. They're contrails. They are basically cirrus clouds that develop as hot, moist air comes out of jet engines and mixes with the environment. And sometimes they form and sometimes they don't fall. It's not really clear what the impact is. There was a study done a couple of years ago after 9/11 when flights were told to stay down, and so there were no contrails. And a colleague of ours looked at what that impact was. But there was a recent study that came out and was looking at some of that analysis, and I don't remember what the results of that.
Yeah.
And by recent, I mean like 2 years ago, which is why I don't remember. Typically, what theoretical studies tend to show, and I think this is what the results of that case study were also showing, was that when you have thin cirrus, thin high clouds develop in the atmosphere, they tend to result in a warming of the planet. The question then is, how much is the aerial extent of that? Because if the extent isn't very big, then the impact won't be very big.
Yeah.
But they tend to reflect solar energy, but they tend to, more importantly, emit infrared radiation down to the surface, which tends to warm it up. So, yeah, chemtrails are just what I'll call a conspiracy that the government is poisoning us, and that's really not the case.
Yeah, it's not true, but the condensation trails, the question's out a little bit.
Yeah.
And thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Eric in Oregon, we turn to you next. Hi, Eric. Eric, are you there?
Hello? Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I guess one of the previous callers sort of reminded me of a little part in a Bill Bryson book where he was talking about a study that was done trying to predict the smoke that was coming off a candle in a closed room. And basically, they weren't really able to do this with current scientific models. And so, to me, what it sort of brings up is the fact that what we're dealing with here, this large worldwide climate patterns and what we possibly are affecting it, is incredibly unpredictable, and maybe we're out of our realm here. But maybe that doesn't matter. You know, maybe we are imposing a lot of carbon dioxide and a lot of other things like methane as well into the atmosphere. And maybe we're playing with something that just is too big for us to play with. Maybe not worth it. And so I guess I'm driving across Wisconsin right now in a veggie oil powered car. And we're looking to buy land and start organic farming with permaculture methods. And I guess I'm just interested in maybe if these conversations are sometimes distractions, and maybe what we need to be talking about is what does this mean? What do we do tomorrow with this information? How can we help mitigate these things and also create a new beautiful future for ourselves and our families?
Well, I sympathize with some of what you're saying, Eric. I think that though that it all stems from feeling some level of confidence about your understanding of the physical world, and because that gives you the platform from which to, first of all, sound the alarm, and then secondly, think about what can be some mitigation strategies, including the ones that you're considering adopting in your own life. So I think you have to do both, and I think that it is a big problem, and there are chaotic elements to the weather and climate. There's no doubt about that. But there are also, just like with the tides, local tides, there's a chaotic element, but they're largely predictable. And our science is a little less predictable than the tides, but there are certain things about it, identifiable forces and processes that we can model to give us insight about what we should expect. one of the greatest examples of that truth is the fact that 50 years ago, you couldn't reasonably expect to have a one-day forecast that you could trust to even plan a picnic the next day. Now, I think you can reasonably expect 3 to 5, sometimes 7 days out in the future, you get a pretty accurate description of the complexion, at a minimum, of the weather that's on your horizon. And that's a remarkable triumph of atmospheric science. And I think that it portends greater ones coming for our confidence, at least, in projections about 50 and 100 years further along in terms of broad-scale changes in the climate, not in the day-to-day weather, but in the climate.
Hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think it's time to move on and use the science to guide the discussions on what do we do tomorrow and what do we do a decade from now, rather than having the discussions kind of trash the science, which is not a good way to go.
Right.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Eric, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Weston, it's your turn. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Just thank you for my call. Just had a quick question in regards to the natural phenomenon that's happening right now in at the Kobuku, I believe you call it, volcano in Peru.
Yes.
And I know we have a lot of models and a lot of statistics and everything else in regards to what's going to happen. You know, everybody talks about what's happening here right now. But what's going to happen as this ash and everything else gets into the jet stream? Well, what countries will this affect next? So I'm wondering if your wonderful guest could enlighten us.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you're talking about wonderful guests. You must mean me.
Yes, it's got to be. I was thinking the same thing. Yeah. But thank you.
So there are two things, a couple of things with regard to the volcanic input on global change, global temperatures in particular. One is that, in general, the explosion has to get up into the stratosphere, so where the debris and, in particular, sulfur dioxide can stay around for a while. And this volcano in Chile, Kobuku, I think that's the right way to pronounce it, got up to, from what I last saw, 60 to 65,000 feet.
Ooh, that's good.
So it's up there. It's
winter
up to
hemisphere,
the stratosphere,
too, right now.
Into the winter hemisphere.
Yeah.
And so the other part of it is then, will it get distributed? I was wondering if it was just going to stay around the South Pole, but somebody was telling me that, no, that it is actually beginning to spread towards the equator.
Mm.
And then the third aspect of it is whether or not it has sulfur dioxide in it. If it has ash in it, eventually the ash will come out relatively quickly, even if it gets into the stratosphere, just gravitational settling. But with sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, that can convert chemically, if it's up in the stratosphere for enough time, into sulfuric acid droplets, and that reflects solar energy out to space, and it ends up cooling the planet. And that was the case for Pinatubo. Satellite measurements that I have seen have indicated that there is sulfur dioxide emitted in that eruption, but I haven't seen how much. So I don't know what
really
that impact will be.
Dramatic satellite.
Video. Yeah.
There is some
gorgeous
pictures from satellites and from ground-based photography.
Right.
It's just this is just an amazing
thing. Yeah, it really is an amazing event.
So it may have an impact. It's got the right ingredients. The degree will be how much of that sulfur dioxide is up there and how much of it is going to spread around the planet.
And I wonder how much would even possibly cross the equator. Probably not very much. You might get pushing towards the equator, but it'll always be in the southern hemisphere,
right.
Would be my initial guess.
Yeah, that's true. So we may see more of an impact. Although Pinatubo affected the global temperature by a half a degree.
Yeah, but did it affect thermometers in the southern hemisphere? It may have, because it's closer to the tropics than the one in Chile.
Yeah, I don't know how much actually got into that.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call with your weather or climate question, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Jerry in Delafield, you're next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I have a question for your weather guys.
Sure.
This morning's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, there was a letter to the editor claiming that they said there was only 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and such a small amount, such a small concentration, cannot possibly affect the Earth's climate. I wonder if the weather guys could clarify how that works.
I wonder what the basis of that assertion was, because carbon dioxide is a very particular molecule among several in our atmosphere that has the property by which incoming radiation from the sun, which is in short wavelengths, gets right through it as if it weren't there. And then when surfaces and objects on the planet absorb that solar radiation and emit their own radiation at a larger wavelength because it's not quite as hot, that's called infrared. And the infrared gets reabsorbed partially by the presence of the carbon dioxide. So if you have increasing amounts of that chemical in your atmosphere, then it stands to reason you'll increasingly absorb and then re-emit otherwise outgoing infrared radiation, and the re-emission process sends some of it back to the surface. So we're warmer than we have a right to be, even in a natural state, uncontaminated state, because of the presence of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. But if we keep raising that amount, then we're going to continue to get a little bit warmer, and that's where we're at some risk.
And sometimes it's not a good idea just to look at whether or not it's big or small. And the thing that I'll point to is the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is relatively small. Mm. And yet it's that water vapor that leads to flooding the storms.
Right.
That's all coming from atmospheric water vapor, which is a very small amount in compared to, for example, nitrogen and oxygen.
Yeah, it's usually less than 1% by mass in almost every place you'd observe on the globe. Some places are exceptionally moist, but most times it's less than 1% of the air that you breathe is water vapor.
And yet it's all about our weather.
You bet it is.
Yeah.
There we go. Thanks, Jerry, for calling. Appreciate it. Bud in the Prairie du Chien wondered what influence the waxing and waning of the continental glaciers has on the concept of climate change.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It's a response to the global warming that we're seeing for sure. What it would do in terms of a feedback is that it would reflect less solar energy into the atmosphere, which would then lead to more warming. But my guess would be that impact would be small, particularly in comparison to the ice sheets, just because the glaciers and the mountains have a relatively small aerial extent.
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree. It would be a guess for me, too. I think that the primary interest that people have in tracking the glaciers is as a diagnostic of what's going on, not really as a sort of a feedback functioning contributor to what's happening.
Yeah.
Dennis wanted to know why he has been seeing such vivid sunsets lately, and there have been some nice ones.
Yeah, he's right about that. I think it's been because of the texture of the clouds the last few nights, at least maybe last week. You know, we had a rainy week for part of the week last week, but a couple of those days the sun was trying to come out right as the sun was going it was coming out just as the sun was going down. And the clouds were sort of textured, and they often are, but sometimes if you get them 3 days in a row, it's hard to miss them one of those days, and so you say, wow, I've been seeing this a lot. And then they were perfectly lit with some of the pink and purple light at the end of the day. I noticed the same thing. It struck me that it was just the texture of the clouds that are sort of behind the stratus, low-level stratus clouds that were raining earlier in the day. They kind of have a little more texture, and there's not anything impeding that.
So red sky at night, sailor's delight? That's the way it works.
Yeah. Red sky morning, sailors take warning.
Yeah.
So the rain clouds have already gone by, and that's why we're getting the colored sunsets.
Yeah, and things move west to east predominantly, so there you go.
Yeah, it's one of those folk sayings that actually we can tie a science thing to.
You can interpret it.
Here, this one you may or may not be able to help with. Treva had a Facebook question. I need to ask about a dying star that I've seen in the southwest sky. You guys know anything about dying stars?
No. How do you know it's dying? It must be through a telescope or something, right? It's got to be.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Well, we can't help you there.
I know they're really violent. When they go through their death throes, it's pretty violent, but maybe they're violent all the time.
So I just want to go back to Chile, that volcanic eruption, you don't really foresee it having a major impact on
I think we're waiting to see what the impact is. Not locally. I don't think it'll have a big thing up here. Yeah. So, but actually, it might spread globally because once it gets into the stratosphere, you know, it's not the circulation is different.
Still generally pole to equator in that Brewer-Dobson circulation. So the equator is a boundary that is difficult to get through. Maybe convection would pop it up and start leaking it into the other hemisphere or something. It's not impossible. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
But we'll have to, I think, wait to see sulfur dioxide was in it.
Somebody else wondered about the amount that we talked about tornadoes earlier. What is and now we're about through April. May a tornado, a big tornado month in Wisconsin?
Not in Wisconsin. It's further south. The southern plains start to really rev up in late April and May, and then it moves further north to the maybe Missouri, Kansas, southern Nebraska by June. You know, it's so interesting. You look at the historic tornadoes. The famous ones in Oklahoma are always in the first week or two of May. The famous one in Omaha was mid-June. And then the Plainfield tornado here was in late July or August. I think the Stoughton tornado was in August. And those are really, they tell you
so
where the main season is.
Yeah, it starts south the retreat of the jet, moves really. Northward, right, with the jet stream.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And then there's a little-known maximum in February, late January, February, down in the southeast U.S., you know, where they're having trouble today, Baton Rouge and places like that. This is a little bit unusual for them, but, yeah. Isn't that something?
Michael in Hillsboro has a comment. Hi, Michael. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm a Brewers fan, and I enjoyed your analogy at the lead into the program about trying to make conclusions about the Brewers' season, that they're having a great season because they won yesterday.
Right, right.
Or because they had one good inning.
Right.
But turn the analogy around and look at the Earth that is, what, 4.5 billion years old?
Yeah.
And we've got, what, 175-ish years of climate data?
Direct observations.
If you look at it that way, how can we make definite conclusions either about the Brewers' season from one game or the data we've got about the climate from what it's been? It's been billions of years.
Yeah, reasonable question. We do have reconstructed data, so it's not direct observational data that, like the kind that we do have for the last 175 years, as you correctly point out. The reconstructed data goes back hundreds of thousands of years, and we have a reasonable degree of confidence in it. I'm probably underplaying that simply because I'm not an expert in how it's reconstructed, but I'm pretty sure that it's a pretty decent record. And so when you put all of that stuff together, you kind of have to look at it as objectively as possible and say, is it telling us something, as Steve pointed out earlier, about our current era, and I mean in the last 150 or so years, that it really is unique? Have we had a 20-run inning in the third inning? And then can we reasonably then conclude that we're going to win this game? I think there's some truth to that. So, you know, what you're saying is not a crazy position to take unless you decide to turn your eyes away from the response, which is there is a lot of data that kind of gives us confidence that what's happening in the last 150 or so years is rather unprecedented in the last million or so years, which we think we can faithfully reconstruct.
Yeah. Mm, interesting. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it. Dennis and Eau Claire, I want to give you a chance to join us, too. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for picking me up. I have a question on winds. It seems like, I don't know, I can't tell you if it was just within the past 5 years or what, but like last week up here in Eau Claire, we had some really strong winds. So that's one question. Where are they coming from? Are the high pressures, low pressures stronger than they used to be because of this climate change stuff? And the second half of that question is, once it gets dark, it seems like the winds just die out.
Mm.
How come?
Yeah. I think, you want to go?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take the night one because it's a lot easier while it dies down. And, so what happens at nighttime, or another way to think of it is really what the sun is doing. When it heats the surface up, it heats the air right next to the ground, and then that hotter air that's just been heated up by its contact with the ground rises. And as it rises, other air from above comes down to replace it. I mean, it's just like, you know, sort of like a, I don't want to say a vacuum, but once you take air from one place, air from another place is going to move in. And so during the day, what that results in is a coupling between the air close to the ground with air up above. And that coupling usually takes air up above, which is traveling faster because friction is a lot lower, makes the winds windier during the day. During the night, when the sun goes down, you get the atmosphere to decouple. And so that air near the ground calms down, where the air above is still traveling pretty quickly.
And the air at the ground gets colder.
And gets colder.
And so you
make
change
it harder to move it around.
Yeah, and that's part of the explanation on the flip side during the daytime. So what happens during the daytime is, as Steve pointed out, the heating of the air that's originally at the ground and then rising away and replaced by air that used to be a little bit above the ground, it ends up heating the whole lowest kilometer or so of the atmosphere, sometimes deeper than that, depending on the conditions, to about the same temperature and that, or the same relative temperature. And so that changes it really increases the ability for the air to mix in the vertical. And so that brings down, you know, you get gusts during the day on a sunny day because that air is coming from a mile or so above the ground with unimpeded all the way to the surface. And that rattles your trees and your windows. And then at night, when the ground cools off, you increase the stability, which really greatly inhibits the mixing of air in the vertical. And so suddenly all that high-speed air can't possibly penetrate down to the ground anymore, even though it had an easy time doing it during the day. So they're all connected together. And I think it's not...
20 seconds for the last answer.
Safe to say that we don't know yet whether or not climate change has increased the intensity of individual day-to-day storms. I'd say that's not the case over the North American continent. That's what I would say right now.
And I like that. I like it when the wind dies down because it helps the fishing, as far as I'm concerned.
There you go.
The waters
but the mosquitoes get out, too.
That's the downside of it. Well, guys, you're going to be back on May 27th, if I'm not mistaken.
That sounds good to me, unless you're doing the Bird Show then.
No, we'll find out.
We'll do right.
It's May 27th. I think you're back then.
Yeah.
We will have Steve Ackerman and John Martin back with us from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Our weather guys, they definitely will be back in the month of May, and I think it's May 27th.
Actually, I think you're right now that I remember Judith contacting us.
I think I'm right. Tomorrow, Jerry Apps joins us. He's got a new book called Whispers and Shadows. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.